I'm your host, Kirsten Sandifer. Today we have an amazing guest, David Crowe. He is a telecommunications consultant, an environmentalist, and a researcher of viruses and other questionable medical paradigms for over 25 years. He is president of Rethinking AIDS, host of the Infectious Myth podcast, and is currently writing a book critiquing viral paradigms for major illnesses with the same title. And he has a degree in biology and mathematics, as well as Italian, Chinese, and Spanish. And his website is http://theinfectiousmyth.com. So welcome, David. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I've been wanting to have someone on the show that could get people to start asking the right questions and to stop just blindly accepting everything about the coronavirus and about everything else, for that matter, to be factual. So I think that's what we're going to try to do, is get them to start asking the right questions. So let's start off with a simple explanation of the problem with calling the coronavirus a virus, if you will.
Yeah, well, I really kind of got my start with SARS. I actually wrote a chapter of a book that's not being published yet, on SARS. And, you know, three things I learned from studying SARS, which is also believed to be coronavirus, is there was lots of evidence it wasn't infectious at all. There wasn't any evidence it was pathogenic. There was no evidence that it existed. Lots of claims, but all the claims were flimsy. And there were many iatrogenic or doctor-caused reasons for illness. And the major one of those was probably intubation, although I didn't really appreciate that at the time, followed by antiviral drugs and high-dose corticosteroids. So there was no need to invoke a virus to explain SARS. The major difference between SARS and the new COVID was that the definition of SARS was somewhat self-limiting. And so once they got everybody who'd been diagnosed with SARS into a hospital, you needed contact with a SARS patient to be yourself diagnosed with SARS. And so that became very, very difficult unless you were a healthcare worker. And so it burned out. Whereas with COVID, they came up with a definition. Basically, if you've got a positive test, you're an infectious case. And of course, they're arguing over whether asymptomatic people are infectious or not. But basically, they've magnified by a factor of like 100,000 or something the devastation of this theory, not the devastation of the virus. But we have the same problems with this new virus. For example, if we talk about infectivity, you know, it's incredibly infectious. But there was this case of an elderly couple from Illinois. The woman came back from Wuhan. The husband was very sick with COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And at some point, they went into emergency, and it was discovered that they were both positive. The CDC rolled into town, and they found over 300 contacts. And I don't know who these people were, but you know, relatives and friends and, you know, probably maybe people who worked in their house. And if they went out to the store to buy food, people there. And they found zero positive cases amongst over 300. And then there was another case in China of a young woman with a congenital heart problem who was in the hospital and, you know, nothing to do with COVID. But after like a week in the hospital, somebody decided, well, why don't we give her a COVID test? And she was positive. In that case, they found around 450 contacts, and they followed up with every single one of the 450 contacts, and they found zero positive. This included her relatives and friends who came to visit her at the hospital, the healthcare workers, other patients, everybody.
Which isn't really possible, I mean, if it's as infectious as they say it is, right?
No. And you know, you also have infections where there's no possibility of being in contact with anybody else. I mean, when it happened in Italy, these cases were obviously false positives. I mean, they were people who'd never, you know, or not within any reasonable amount of time traveled to China, hadn't been with anybody who was a known case, hadn't been with anybody who had recently been to China, et cetera, et cetera. And yet they never asked the question, is this test producing false positives? And we know it's producing garbage results because, for example, there was a series of 18 people in Singapore. They were all patients in the hospital, and every day for some reason, or every other day, they got a COVID test. And what they discovered was that the majority of the 18 people were positive one day or infected, negative the next day or uninfected, and a couple of days later, positive again. And in some cases, this happened multiple times. I think in China and South Korea, they were monitoring people more closely after they left. You know, they turned negative, they left the hospital, but they kept monitoring them. And they were finding like 5 to 15% were testing positive again. I mean, this is just a garbage test. You don't need to understand the technology, which would tell you some of the reasons why it might be a problem. But just the results that the test is producing are impossible. The maybe slightly humorous story was a 68-year-old man from Hefei, China, who had some symptoms, the completely nonspecific symptoms of COVID. There are no COVID symptoms, like fever and cough, just like a million other possible things. So he goes to the hospital, he tests positive, he's in the hospital, he tests negative twice, his symptoms have gone away, so they let him out into quarantine for 14 days. They test him a few days later, he's positive. They drag him back to the hospital, put him on antiviral drugs, even though he's not sick, and a few days later, he tests negative four times. They let him out. Three or so days later, he tests positive again. So they drag him back to the hospital, put him on antiviral drugs. And then after a few days, he tested negative. I don't know how many times they tested him this time, maybe eight times. He was negative every time, and they let him out. And that's as far as the story went. I mean, I don't know if he got dragged back a couple more times. But nobody in that paper said, you know, maybe this guy's producing false positives. They just assume that if the machine, you know, produces a positive result, that is the gospel. And it is basically a religion. You know, if the Bible says
David,
something...
Go ahead.
If the Bible says something impossible and you have faith, or the Quran or whatever holy book you follow, if it says something mm-hmm. that's clearly impossible, if you're a true believer, you believe the impossible. And that's where we are with this the so-called science on COVID. Some of it's impossible, but you believe it anyway because you're a science-oriented person, which means you have faith in science. It does not mean that you're actually a scientist in the sense that you analyze data.
Yeah, I mean, that's just silly to me because science is supposed to be asking the right questions and getting to the truth of the matter,
anymore. If you are, say, a Democrat in the United States, which likes to think it's the party of science, then you have faith in scientists. And if you argue with them, they will eventually say, look, I'm going to trust the experts. And if anybody says they're going to trust the experts, they are not a scientist. They are not thinking scientifically. They are thinking with faith and religiously. And that's how science is treated nowadays. It's a religion. If somebody has a PhD in a white coat or an MD, then you believe what they say, even if it's impossible.
Yeah.
Lewis Carroll said, I think, sometimes I believe 10 impossible things before breakfast. And if you can do that, then you're doing well because you're going to fit right in.
Well, thanks for that. So what is the problem with PCR testing in general, and why is it not an accurate test for this?
Well, the official full name is RT, reverse transcriptase, qPCR, Q for quantitative, PCR, polymerase chain reaction. So the polymerase chain reaction is a manufacturing technique for DNA. The Q indicates that they're trying to actually measure the amount of DNA. So it used to be you'd start with one strand of DNA, say you've got the insulin gene for humans. At the end of the day, you've got a billion insulin genes for humans, which you can put in bacteria and produce, you know, human insulin, something like that. But in this case, you start with an unknown quantity of DNA, and we'll get to the RNA later. For simplicity, you start with an unknown quantity of DNA, and you multiply it, and on each cycle, the amount approximately doubles. So if you had 10 molecules to start with, you'd have 20 on the second and 40 on the next. The problem is that PCR is not a perfect process, So you might only get like 9.5 or 9 on the first cycle. And then, of course, because the amount doubles each time, your error also doubles. So PCR itself is not really quantitative. The RT, reverse transcriptase, means that you're actually starting with RNA. And in order to get PCR to work, you need DNA. And what you need to do is convert the RNA to DNA, which you use the reverse transcriptase enzyme for. But according to Stephen Buston, who I interviewed, who's like probably the world's top expert on quality control for this technology, the efficiency of reverse transcriptase is not more than 50%, and it varies by about a factor of 10. So if you start with a particular quantity of DNA, the amount of, pardon me, of RNA, the amount of DNA you start with at the beginning of the PCR cycle could vary by a factor of 10, depending on which lab you used, which enzyme you used, what other chemicals you used.
And they don't standardize this across the board as how many cycles or how many that's going to be included in each test?
Okay, so I looked at 33 FDA approved, and I should put approved in ironic quotes because this was an emergency use authorization, so there was really no approval. The number of cycles went from 30 to 45. Now, Buston said you shouldn't use 40 or more cycles because there's too many false positives, but the majority of tests did. And because it doubles at each cycle, the difference between 30 and 45 is about a factor of 60,000. And these are all tests that are claiming to look for the same thing. The tests looked for different portions of the RNA genome, which are they called genes. And in some cases, they looked for one or two or three genes. And if they looked for two genes, sometimes they said, if you need both to be positive. Other times they said either one. And then for three, they usually said two out of three. So that means you can test positive on this test and you're missing a piece of the virus. Doesn't make a lot of sense. So there's incredible inconsistencies between the tests. But did you ever see somebody report that, say, Omaha has done 3,000 tests and we used this machine, and Nebraska did 5,000 tests and they used a different machine? You'll never see that. They believe that every one of these machines is magically going to produce the same results, and they're completely interchangeable. There's been basically no cross-validation. By that, I mean, you got 33 tests. Well, let's take, you know, a sample of 100 samples and run it through all 33 tests. See what we get. Like, you might think that some produce more positives than negatives, but there were probably lots of cases where, you know, a test produces a negative on this sample and the other test produces a positive, and then it's the other way around for a different sample. So anyway, the cycle number, 30 to 45, basically can be used in a very simple calculation to determine how much RNA you started with, except for the fact that you can't, because you have all these errors along the way. You not only have errors during PCR and it doesn't always perfectly replicate, but you have errors during the reverse transcriptase phase, plus you have errors during the RNA extraction phase, which is the first one, which you don't really need to go into except to know that it's not perfect either. So you basically are applying a pseudo-quantitative standard, a cycle number, to determine if somebody's positive or negative, knowing, or you should know, that it's not actually quantitative. And if you run the test twice, you know, as if you get, if say you detect enough material at, say, 33 cycles on two samples, that doesn't mean you detected the same amount of material, or not even close.
Well, I'm sure people are kind of saying, oh, well, what's the problem with false positives? You just get quarantined for a little while, but No, I mean, this is entirely inaccurate way of reporting the data to us. Plus, as we've seen, the implications of somebody being quarantined for a long time are, you know, often disastrous.
Yeah, and it also boosts the, you know, like now they're not talking about deaths because, you know, the number of deaths are very small, perhaps because they've backed off on some of their treatments. Like they're not doing much intubation anymore because they realized it was killing everybody. But the number of cases is supporting these people who are talking about a second wave and that we can't back off on the lockdown and all this kind of stuff. The more positive cases we get, the more ammunition those people have to say, we need to stop the economy from continuing to reopen. Now, you could say that, okay, if the asymptomatic people are mostly false positives, then that means that the fatality rate of the virus is much higher. But even that's flawed logic, because we don't know in a single person whether the detection of this RNA is actually the cause of the illness. And other causes are that, I mean, another likely cause is that you're treating people much more aggressively. I mean, you intubate people when you wouldn't normally intubate people. And in New York City, amongst 65 plus people, they had a 97% death rate. So if you diagnose somebody as COVID positive and they have some symptoms, and many of these people are elderly and have multiple symptoms, then it's very easy to kill them with intubation. I think there's a couple other reasons for the high death rate. And many people say we didn't lock down nursing homes soon enough. I think that the lockdown of nursing homes was a disaster, and that's when the death rate climbed. And the multiple reasons for this is if there's no visitors, then the visitors aren't doing all those functions that they do, that they're helping feed their loved one, they're, you know, helping keep them clean and things like that. It takes a load off the staff, but they're also monitoring the care. And if they see bad practices, they're gonna talk about it. So then the staff, which now has a little bit less assistance from the visitors, has quarantined staff members. They have staff members too scared to come to work. And so now you're down to like half staff. You got these poorly paid people and they're running around unable to keep up with what needs to be done. So that leads to unsanitary practices because nobody has time to do things properly. It leads to neglect, like people who are, you know, basically semi-conscious or just left without food for days, or they're left in bed and they're not turned. It leads to abuse where the staff get frustrated and then they start pushing around the patients if the patients, you know, won't do things. But most of all, it leaves the patients with no stimulation. And if you take somebody from, say, a situation where they have a visitor once a week and the nursing home brings in, you know, some outside group of a choir or, you know, somebody to draw with them or physiotherapy or, you know, the little bits of stimulation they get, they may be able to go in their wheelchair to the dining room and eat with other people. You take all of that away and people will die, because they have nothing to live for. You're lying in your bed 24 hours a day, staring at the ceiling. Somebody comes along, shoves some food in your mouth, maybe three times a day, maybe less. You know, maybe you get washed, but not as often as possible. Your diaper gets changed, but not as often as it should. And you're miserable. And then a lot of governments have stated that they don't want these patients in ICU. So in Spain, for example, they were very reluctant to transfer nursing home patients to ICUs. And the Palliative Care Society said, if a patient cannot be transferred to an ICU and they're in pain, you start palliative sedation. And the end of palliative sedation is death. You keep upping the dose. And then when you max the dose on one sedative, you go to a stronger one. And at some point, this poor old person just doesn't wake up.
Wow. that brings up a lot of questions about the transmission as well of the virus. How can we actually know how it is transmitted if we don't know if any of these tests are accurate and how it's...
Well, we'd like to think this is all very scientific, right? So, for example, if you were in Wuhan and you came back to the United States or Canada or England or whatever on one of those rescue flights, and you tested positive, everybody would say, oh, you got infected by somebody in Wuhan. There's actually zero evidence for that. It could be a false positive. You know, how can you prove, you know, I say I didn't go to the wet market. It's a city of 11 million people. Was someone walking down the street coughing just as you walked by who had COVID? I mean, there's zero evidence for most of these things. If there's a plausible connection, then they claim that that is a proven transmission. So if you visit somebody who turned out to have COVID, and then you have COVID, they will say that that is transmitted. And on the other hand, if you have these situations where there's hundreds of people who don't get positive, you just say, you know, it's a mystery why it's not being transmitted to people. Or, for example, there was one of the first cases in Italy was like an 80-year-old man, 88-year-old man in San Marino, this beautiful little town on a hill that's also a country. And he hadn't traveled. He hadn't been around anybody. There was no plausible connection. But they just assumed that one day, miraculously, they will find that he had a Chinese cleaner and her mother had just come back from Wuhan or something, right? They just assume that out there, if you knew everything, there would be this proof of virus communication, as opposed to saying, well, you know, if there's no plausible connection, maybe this is a false positive. But, you know, he gets sent to the hospital, he might get intubated, he dies, and it's a COVID death. The scientific advisor to the Italian Minister of Health was interviewed in the Telegraph, probably about March or April. And he said that in Italy, we're very generous with our diagnoses. And they think that only about 1 out of 7 people marked down as a COVID death actually died from COVID. The Italians found that 60% of the people who died with an average age of 80, that 60% had 3 or more pre-existing health conditions. And there was only a tiny fraction who had no pre-existing health conditions. So he might have died of kidney failure, heart failure, being intubated, liver failure. There's numerous reasons why these people might have died, but they're recorded because they're COVID positive. They're recorded as COVID, which boosts the death numbers dramatically.
Wow. So these people's actual diagnosis are completely being overlooked and the real cause of death, and they're just to mark it down to fit the numbers or to fit these statistics.
Yeah, it's a state of total panic because they believe that the worst thing in the world is missing a COVID case. And it's better to have 100 people marked down as COVID who aren't than it is to miss the one who really truly died of COVID. And, you know, you say, well, they also had heart disease and stuff, but, you know, how do you know they died of COVID? I mean, every doctor I discovered who's outspoken claims to have a clear picture of what COVID disease is. It's hypoxia, it's this or that. And the notable thing is that when these doctors say this, they, unless they're in a little clique that all kind of agree together, they're saying quite different things. Some people are saying it's vitamin D deficiency. Well, there may be a cluster of things that make old people die. And that's exacerbated by the iatrogenic killings.
Why are the masks ineffective? I know people currently think that respiratory droplets are the way to, you know, spread the disease. Is that accurate at all? And do the masks even help?
Well, there's been a lot of contradictory information. It seems that I just read a paper that said masks, surgical masks, don't even reduce the risk of infection during surgery. let alone, you know, walking down the street. Like, the assumption is that you can walk down the street and somebody walks by you and they're not coughing or anything, but, you know, somehow magically the virus gets from their face to yours. But there's very little evidence. There is evidence that people who live together for a long time are more likely to all become COVID positive. But that also might be environmental. There's a very strong correlation between testing COVID positive, between dying from so-called COVID, and one other thing that I can't remember right now, and air pollution. So Wuhan's polluted, Lombardy, Italy, the hotspot in Italy is polluted, New York is polluted, London, England's polluted. And so they can correlate these factors with particulate matter, nitrogen oxide, ozone levels, et cetera, et cetera. So if you live in the same house and you have poor air quality, that could explain why there's a higher probability of two or more people testing positive. Might also explain why prisoners are testing positive. Prisoners in jails are testing positive in large numbers, but there's not a lot of illness. It could be that they're exposed to a bad respiratory environment that causes your body to produce the RNA that gets picked up as this test result. And I should remind people that the PCR test is only looking for about 1% of the 30,000 base genome. So that's like about 300 bases. So when you get a COVID positive test, you're not finding the entire genome, you're finding 1% of it. So if your body produces that chunk of the RNA, and you're in a prison, and you know the air quality is lousy, that could explain that. Also, meatpacking plants, but I don't really have a theory about what in the air would be causing that. But people are working indoors, you know, for long shifts, and possibly there's some factor in the air that makes it more likely for you to test positive. So it's not necessarily that the infection is running around these facilities. It could just be that you're in a similar environment. And people get really confused. Like if you know, three people in the same house get sick, they assume it's a virus, right? But you're sharing the same environment.
Could that 1% also possibly be caused by like the fear and panic and whatnot? Could that be part of it?
Yeah, I haven't really considered that, but you know, it's possible. I mean, stress does crazy things to us. I know with HIV, there's a lot of prejudice that goes into tests. So for example, if you say you're a gay man, you're more likely to have your test turn out positive. I don't know if with COVID there's any, you know, any such bias. I mean, one bias is that, for example, if you find one person in a prison who's positive, you probably go in and test everybody. Whereas if you don't expect to have positive cases, let's say, you know, workers in some other kind of facility, you don't test them and therefore you don't find a bunch of positives. So there is a lot of bias in who you decide to test. I mean, at first they tested sick people and now it's like certain facilities that they like to test. And then of course there's the worried people who just come in for tests obsessively because somehow they think that if they test positive, it's going to be of benefit to them.
What are the dangers of using the antivirals like chloroquine, ribavirin, and the corticosteroids?
Okay, so chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine are anti-malaria drugs. Chloroquine has a fair amount of toxicity. Hydroxychloroquine, I interviewed Remington Nevin, who's a world expert on these drugs, and he said about 10% of people can't tolerate them. But if you have somebody on an intubator, how do they tell you that they can't tolerate this drug? Mm-hmm. You give it to them, they die on the intubator, and you have no idea what happened. I think hydroxychloroquine is largely relatively innocuous, but that doesn't mean that it's beneficial. Now, remdesivir, on the other hand, is in the class of nucleoside analogs, or it may be technically not quite a nucleoside analog, but it's very close. AZT, the first AIDS drug, was a nucleoside analog, and it was fearsome in its toxicity. So remdesivir is going to have a lot of the same toxicity as AZT. Gilead has produced a lot of AIDS drugs, a lot of which are nucleoside analogs, and so they have a lot of experience in this area producing toxins. You know, each year the dose is a little bit less and the price is a little bit higher, so it's a good business to be in. Remdesivir is obviously a scam. The Gilead, on one of the trials, changed the endpoint of the trial halfway through as completely scientifically bogus thing to do. And they did that to basically remove death as one of the primary endpoints. So they could say people left hospital 4 days earlier if they survived. But we're not counting death as a primary endpoint. So, you know, what good is this? The Chinese found a higher rate of death. I don't think anybody's really found a significantly lower rate of death. But, you know, Tony Fauci came out and said, remdesivir is a game changer. Like, what's this neutral bureaucrat coming out with a statement that's designed to boost the stock price of Gilead? And there were lots of things. I think Fauci released some early data from a study that hadn't, you know, got to the point where they should have released data yet. Like, this is clearly the fix is in for stuff like remdesivir versus possibly not doing anything. You know, like, what if you treated these patients as if they didn't have COVID and you just treated them as saying, okay, they've got pneumonia, they have difficulty breathing for various reasons because of they've got chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which makes it difficult to breathe. You know, what if you just treated them normally? Would you get a much greater survival?
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting question. And I think one of the questions that people should be asking, and also about the bodies, like, if this was such an epidemic or pandemic, why aren't the bodies piling up? What are some of the other questions that people should be asking right now?
Well, I mean, there was a surge in deaths in many places, mm-hmm. but it was fairly short. And before and after the surge, deaths, total deaths, were not really higher than normal. And I think the surge can reflect the iatrogenic killings, the isolation of old people. Yep. So basically, if you isolate old people, if you're fairly tough and you don't have too much wrong with you, you might get through it, right? It'll be miserable, but you might get through it. But if you're if you're in pain, and you know, you're suffering from untreated conditions because they didn't want to send you to the ICU, then you're going to be one of the first to die. So I think they wiped out a cohort of old people who would have died in the fall or early next year. But they would have died with their family at their side. They would have had a few more months. They wouldn't have been sedated so much until the very end. And so their quality of life at the end of their life could have been significantly better. And so what we might see is a lower than normal death rate once this is all over. And then we'll have to say, okay, so basically what you did is you moved the deaths up by 3 or 6 months.
Yeah. So what kind of questions should people be asking, though, what of their doctors, of the people around them, to kind of get, you know, get them some answers?
Well, it depends what issue is most important to you. It reminds me of AIDS, because there is no question. There's no piece of, quote, science that is not worth questioning. You know, whether it's the infectivity, the utility of the drugs, whether the virus exists, whether the virus is causing illness, there is nothing that's not worth questioning. I think one of the big things that we really need to question right now is the use of masks. Yep. Because there is really no solid evidence that the masks do reduce infections, and they're being used as kind of a political tool to show that you are a follower of this theory, and they're trying to force people to act as if they believed in this theory, because as soon as you put on a mask, that is a symbol that you believe. And I think we need to resist this. It's you know, because you talked about my health condition, which is cancer, which the allopathic doctors believe is terminal. I had to go to the hospital for a procedure, and I had a mask on, and I couldn't breathe. Like, I hadn't experienced this before, but I was starting to have a panic attack. So I took the mask off, and in the room, I explained to the nurse that I just can't wear this mask. I just can't breathe properly. But nobody's got sympathy for the people who've got asthma or, you know, who have easily get panic attacks or anything like that. You're all supposed to do the same thing. Like, I don't know if I go on an airplane, if there's any way that I can avoid mask wearing. But, you know, I think every little bit of civil disobedience, like people who get on the airplane and then keep taking their mask off, things like that, will eventually wear down the mask fanatics, where it will become too much bother. I mean, I already see this. I go to a store where everybody has to wear masks, and half of them are under the nose of the person. They're not covering the nose, or not covering the mouth, or they've been pushed up on their head, because people can't work with masks all day. It's just not possible, right? It's reducing the amount of oxygen we get. We're rebreathing moist air. At certain times of the year, like if it's 35 degrees outside, I mean, how do you wear a mask when it's like that?
No, I agree. And I think it also goes to a bigger issue, and just giving your consent to something. If you don't know and you don't have the answers about it yourself, you've got to be willing to go, you know, go find them and not just blindly consent to things. Because where does it end?
Yes.
You know, I know everybody thinks this is, you know, the new norm is going to be after things die down. Well, I think that they might be mistaken. I think the government's hoping this is the new norm.
And I honestly don't know why. I mean, I have a lot of friends who think this is some grand conspiracy cooked up by, I wanted to say Steve Jobs, but Bill Gates and the World Health Organization and stuff. I don't think it's really like this. I think they had a plan, a very simplistic plan about how to deal with a pandemic. And they convinced themselves that if they get on it early and they use all the ammunition they have, that they can wipe this thing out. And so according to them, it should never have left Wuhan, because nobody locked down harder than they did in Wuhan. And yet all of a sudden it's all over the world, you know, in infecting people who couldn't have been infected by anybody else. But the faith in the system was so great that even with this grand failure of the system, that they weren't able to stop it, that it basically went to every country in the world, bar a few tiny islands. And they probably just haven't tested enough on those islands. Or maybe the air quality is so good that, you know, nobody has this RNA. It was an utter failure by their own standards, but you now have every politician in the world, bar, you know, a few like Bolsonaro and a couple others, completely in line with destroying the world's economy, destroying people's lives, interrupting children's education, interrupting the socialization of children and old people and, you know, everybody. Mm-hmm. They got themselves into a trap, and they can't get out. The politicians want to get out looking like heroes. No politician.
It kind of feels similar to the Gulf War, like when we got ourselves in that, you know, hot mess, and then we didn't know how to get out of it. It's kind of like, well, okay.
Yeah, I mean, wars are like that, because, you know, you get in the war, everybody's gung-ho, you realize you're never going to win this thing, but you're at a point where you can't admit it. But then like 5 or 10 years later, you're negotiating with the Taliban or whoever, right? And you get out of it by negotiations you could have done at the very beginning, right? I mean, did they really need to go into Afghanistan in 2001, or was that just because, you know, they needed to show some force? They could have negotiated with the Taliban. They could have got bin Laden if they'd really wanted to, right? They could have made it a small surgical operation But they made it this huge thing, and they got in so deep that they're still there. God knows when American troops will actually be out of Afghanistan.
Well, it's like they're afraid to say that they did something wrong, too. They don't want to do that, heaven forbid. So,
I mean, the Prime Minister of Norway said that they probably shouldn't have locked down. So that was great. But I wrote an article that said that even Sweden locked down, because to me, the most significant part of the lockdown was the lockdown of the nursing homes, and that was the most deadly. And so Sweden did the same thing as everything else. So the Norwegians, you know, the Prime Minister probably believes that they shouldn't have locked down young people, but they should have locked down nursing homes harder, and that would have killed more people. So he's not exactly right. You know, in Sweden, why was the death rate intermediate? It was less than England and Italy and Spain, but it was more than Denmark and Norway. Well, I think if you looked at the details of the lockdown of nursing homes and the quality of the staff and the staffing levels and things like that, you'd probably find your answers there. A lot of that information is not available. But basically, everybody was locking down nursing homes in approximately the same way, and the death rates were approximately the same. You can argue over the details. There may also be significant differences in countries in terms of how, when people go to nursing homes. You know, in Asia, people tend to stay at home much longer. Mm-hmm. A nursing home would be a last resort. But in many countries, a nursing home is just a dumping ground for inconvenient old relatives. So there'd be many, many more people in them, and therefore the death rate would be higher.
Well, David, you've alluded to this, but we haven't really discussed it per se. But what do you think is a more likely explanation of what COVID actually is?
Well, I think it is a iatrogenic panic. That they did a bunch of things that are deadly. They intubated. They should have probably, if they had 25,000 ventilators, of which they probably used 2,500, they probably should have used 25. They gave frail old people essentially experimental drugs. And I don't care if it's hydroxychloroquine or remdesivir or some antiviral drug or corticosteroids. You're adding more drugs as a burden to elderly people who don't need them. I mean, the death rate was almost entirely in old people. And I think if you know...
Now we know why.
Yeah. The Italians have done a pretty good job. I keep quoting their statistics because they've done a pretty good job in sort of reporting what they found. Like they report the percentage of people who got antiviral drugs. But it's quite a high percentage. And these are antiviral drugs are very toxic. And these people are probably already on heart pills and kidney pills and liver pills and God knows what else. And now you're just adding to their chemical burden. I don't see how that extends their life. I mean, there's no scientific justification because there is not a single drug that's actually been approved for COVID, which is not surprising given how new it is. So any drug that you give for COVID is I don't even want to use the word experiment, because an experiment is kind of a rational thing, right? You give half the people hydroxychloroquine and you do something else for the other half. That's an experiment. But when the doctor just says, well, like in China, in one paper, they said, well, we had this AIDS drug called lopinavir on the shelf. So why don't we give it them that? You know, that's the kind of logic that gets
thrown stuff at the wall to see what sticks.
Or a doctor says, well, I heard from this guy in France, Didier Raoult, that hydroxychloroquine is really great, so we'll give him that. Or, you know, the Gilead comes calling and says, hey, we can start up a clinical trial in your hospital. And, you know, we're going to give you all these goodies if you do it. So, okay, we'll give people remdesivir. It's not scientific logic in the least.
Yeah. Speaking of the vaccines, they're looking at, I mean, there's so many companies talking about coming out with a vaccine, which, needless to say, it's supposed to take about, what, 10 years for to be able to develop a vaccine, and they're pushing this out in less than two. I mean, that's concerning.
And I think there's like about a 10% chance that a vaccine will be approved, even though they have very low standards for approval. a lot of them are so obviously ineffective or toxic that they just don't get approved. So yeah, there's this another naive belief on the part of the dogmatists that they can have a vaccine by September. I mean, this is absurd. It can be proven safe in animals and humans and proven effective in a type of vaccine that's never been used before. They had to abandon SARS vaccines because they were too dangerous. I think these vaccines are more like stock scams than they are anything else. That really? I can't remember the name of this company, but you know, when you have the executives of the company selling all their stocks before bad news comes out and you know, very well politically connected, I just don't trust these things. So I think they're going to fall on their face. I mean, an example, in 1984, when the head of U.S. Human Health Services, HHS, stood up and said, our esteemed Dr. Robert Gallo has shown that HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. And she also said in that speech, and we anticipate, or maybe Gallo said it, we anticipate a vaccine in 2 years. I don't know how many years it's been since 84, yeah. But they've had hundreds of vaccine trials and not a single success. So just saying that you're going to have a vaccine in 6 months or 2 years is total hyperbole.
And would you take the vaccine if they released one?
They'd have to hold me down.
Yeah. Yep. What's the problem with the antibody tests being developed, or the antibody tests?
Well, I did look into the antibody tests quite deeply while I was when I was feeling better, and they seem to be producing very low numbers of positive people. You also have the same problem that they're approved under emergency authorization. There's numerous different tests looking for different antibodies and using different technologies and things like that. But a PCR test is a snapshot, right? If I was to test everybody in the United States on one day with a PCR test, I would find only the people who were infected today, if we can assume the test works. But if I tested the same, you know, 330 million people with an antibody test, I would find everybody who had ever been infected since January, or maybe it was around before, some people say. So the percentage of antibody positive antibody tests should be much, much higher than the percentage of PCR tests. And yet what were we seeing? We were seeing rates of of PCR tests of like 25% testing positive in the early part of the epidemic. You know, partly because they chose really sick people, so the chances were greater, but it just seemed really high that you would have on one day, you would have 25% of sick people would all have COVID. But people wanted to believe that because, you know, they wanted to believe it was ravaging the country. But then you go to antibody tests and you find that like 1% or 2% or 3% are testing positive. And that's the sum total of everybody who's been infected between January and the date you do the tests. So the numbers seem really low. But even if you put that aside, the question is, are the antibodies protective? And I'm not going to talk about viruses here, but let's say, does the presence of antibodies prove that you will never become RNA positive? Well, that would take a long time to prove that. And does the absence of antibodies, a negative antibody test, prove that you're vulnerable? Or, as some people have said, there may be other reasons why you will never become RNA positive. Like there's so much that's not known. What you would really have to do is something I recommend, an experiment kind of like this. So you take 1,000 people who have never reported symptoms or positive tests of any kind. And on day one, you follow them, say, once a week, 1,000 people. They get a PCR test and an antibody test every week. And then in theory, what should happen is some of them become PCR positive. And then after a week or two or three, they start to develop antibodies. And then the PCR RNA goes away and some of the antibodies persist. That's the theory. Well, let's see if it pans out in practice. I believe that it wouldn't. There's absolutely no evidence that it would. But they have this fervent belief that antibodies are highly predictable, they last forever, they're protective. And none of that is anything other than a hunch, not even a hypothesis, really. They've just been taught this in school. And you know, another thing I saw in one of my articles, I put in two graphs, you know, one from a test manufacturer, one from a scientific paper, showing the development of antibodies in theory. And these two graphs, done by experts in the field, were considerably different in terms of the timing of antibodies. And they had suspiciously smooth curves that you know in practice would not happen. And when you look at the validation information in the tests, which is very, very skimpy, you see quite a few anomalies, you know, in terms of people testing positive for antibodies and then negative and then positive again, things like that. The reality would be extremely messy if you had the data. So if you don't have the data, then you can't be upset because the data is not supporting your theory.
Okay, well, thanks for that. We only have a couple minutes left, and I just kind of want to summarize. What do you think is a more likely explanation? I've heard you talk on other podcasts about that our energy bodies are electric, that it could be something that we developed from, you know, just interaction with other people. What do you think that COVID could be?
Well, I don't think we have to think it's something, and I think that's a fundamental error. Okay. When somebody says AIDS is ravaging the world, and you believe that AIDS is a single thing, you're wrong. And that is the fundamental error. If they can get you to believe that, you've already gone halfway. And so if they can get you to believe that COVID is a single thing, when it has no symptoms, it's diagnosed by lousy tests, they can get you to believe anything. So it's really important to resist the whole idea that COVID is a coherent entity of any kind, that it's a coherent illness, that it's a coherent virus or some other thing like that. You have maybe a million individuals around the world who are COVID positive, and their symptoms are all over the map, from none to dying of liver failure. That doesn't mean it's a single entity, and we need to resist the whole concept of COVID. I mean, like I say, every part of the COVID theory can be questioned, and we need to do that. Don't accept any part of it, because I don't believe that there's really anything significant about it that's true.
And even if one part can be, you know, can be flimsy and fall apart with questioning, then that means the whole, you know, there's something wrong with the whole of it. So I think.
Yeah. In 1996, Peter Duisberg wrote a book called Inventing the AIDS Virus. And it's like 1,000 pages. I read through it and I thought, he's identified so many flaws, and so many of them would result in the total rejection of the HIV/AIDS theory. It's not like he just said, you know, here's this long, convoluted argument. If you accept all of my assumptions, HIV doesn't cause AIDS. It was like, here's an independent theory that says HIV doesn't cause AIDS, and here's another one, and here's another one, and here's another one. So he only has to be right on one of them, and the whole thing falls apart. And I mean, that's true here. I mean, let's say that it's a virus, but it's not transmissible.
Do you think more doctors will start feeling comfortable to speak up about this soon, or?
They only speak up within a relatively constrained area. Like I have seen very few doctors who question the existence of the virus or question if it can cause disease. So I think doctors by their nature have a really hard time, getting to the real bottom. Like I've interviewed Andrew Kaufman, who obviously has gone all the way, and there are others. There are more voices coming out saying, you know, there might not be a virus here, but that's tiny compared to the doctors who have good criticisms, but they're built within the viral theory, right? Like the fatality rate is much lower than they say, or it's not infectious outside the home, or something like that, right? They have good information, but they're not going all the way, so to speak.
Okay, well, and I also just wanted to wish you, David, our prayers and best wishes during this time. He's been kind enough to take this time out of his day to keep us informed, keep us in the know while battling cancer right now. So he needs all of our support and kind thoughts, and we wish you all the best, David.
Yes, I hope to get through this. I have to use alternative methods because the allopathic doctors wrote me off basically on day one. And when I'm well again, I'm going to be back, and I'm
absolutely
going to be more pain in the ass tonight.
Yep. We will have you back on soon. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you, Kristen.
Right. Bye-bye. Bye.